sexual education.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Sponsored by the TBI, Survivors Network at TBISN.com.
All survivors, all the time. For automatic updates and everything brain injury.
Join now at TBISN.com.
The only all survivor and family network in the world.
Listen every night at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern.
And sit last night at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern.
Almost 60 shows monthly bringing you unique perspectives and journeys of real lives affected by brain injury.
Sharing their successes and failures.
How do I feel by the end? Would you believe in a love at first?
And now it is time for another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Found at braininjuryradio.com.
Hello? Hello?
Sorry for the technical problems. Julie or Dr. Newman, if you can hear me, please say hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt. Hello? Hello?
I hear Dr. Newman, but I don't hear Julie. Hi, Dr. Newman.
Hey, Matt.
Sorry for
you?
The technical problems.
I'm fine. I'm trying to figure this out.
I don't know what has encountered.
Hello?
Julie, if you can hear me, hang back up and call back in. I have no idea. I've tried to call the bosses, and they're away to a conference.
That's not good.
No.
Well, I'm assuming if anybody can get it figured out, you can, Matt.
I'm working on it. I see if Julie's called in from another number. I know I have, and I've Skyped in. Maybe she's doing that now, and she's calling back in. Dr. Newman, please stand by with us. I hope this is working. I'm not for sure what has taken place. I actually got on the air about 2 minutes late, and I heard nothing. I said, ah!
Yeah, I was trying to listen in, too, and it was just dead air.
Right. I don't know if she's not connected herself properly or her phone's not connecting in, or her Skype, or what?
Mm. Are you there?
We're back now live with Julie Kent and Dr. Don Newman. Goodbye.
Thank you, Matt.
Hi. Thanks, Matt. Hi, Dr. Newman. Sorry about that craziness.
No worries. How are you, Julie?
Good, thanks. I'm so glad to finally have you on here. I've been very excited for you to come on and share all your information with us. I think it's really important.
Julie, there's a lot of feedback going on.
All right, I think I'm going to turn Matt off because I think that's the... Is that better?
There we go.
Okay. All right.
Awesome.
Okay, sorry about that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's get started. Why do you feel scientific research is important for people with brain injury?
Well,
are you there?
I think,
okay.
Yeah, I'm here. Just every once in a while, that there's a screeching sound in the background. Do you hear it?
No, I don't.
Huh. It almost sounds like a teapot going off. It's screeching.
Well, I'll
do my best.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'll work through it. So, why is research important for brain injury? Well, in, at least from my opinion, I got into research about 7 or 8 years ago. I used to be a clinician working for people with brain injuries. I was a cognitive therapist. And while I absolutely loved doing that and working one-on-one with patients and realizing how helpful that was, I started working with patients back in the late 90s and really was very frustrated by the lack of knowledge and understanding that we had about brain injury, what we know and how to approach treatment, et cetera. And this was in, like I said, the late 90s. And we, you know, now in 2014, we have come leaps and bounds, kind of like the name of your talk show, Quantum Leap.
That's why I named it that way.
It's perfect. We really have made a lot of progress in terms of our understanding and the research that we've done. However, we are still so far behind in the game of really understanding brain injury and knowing how to treat it effectively, because it is such a complicated injury that affects each and every person so uniquely and so differently. It really is a challenging thing to sort of wrap our head around, so to speak. And so I think that research is just so important to advancing our knowledge and understanding and being able to better and more effectively treat people with brain injuries and to improve quality of life. Without research, really, things are just going to stay status quo, and we really won't know where to go. Doing research, it drives, our ability to be able to look at things more critically and more effectively. So to me, I think research is really where it's at, and so that's why when I was a therapist and I decided, you know what, I really want to go back for my PhD, and I want to do research, because to me, I felt like this is where we are really going to be able to make a difference at a much larger level, and we really, really need it.
I agree. I wouldn't have been able to go back to college if it wasn't for research, because when I had my accident, it was pretty much, there you go, that's all, we can do for you, and that was it. But as the years progressed, and I still had issues, not as bad as most people, or a lot of people have them, but, I worked very hard to get better and to get my cognitive ability back. And as I worked hard, so did science, and that enabled me to go back to school. And so that is one of the reasons why I did this show, because it's really important for people to have that understanding of why it's important. And, let's talk about why being a research participant, because research can't happen without the participants.
Absolutely. Without the participants, research can't be done. We need people to, want to participate and agree to participate in studies. Really, I think from my experience in working with patients with brain injury and having them come in as a participant, so many people, they really get enjoyment out of participating in a research study, one, because it's really self-fulfilling, and it's really a way to say, hey, look, I can help out, and whatever I can do to help, they're always so, I think it provides this sense of being, this contribution that they're making. Because there's so many different types of research studies, whether it's a study where we're just trying to understand what's going on in the brain, or if it's actually an intervention study where we're providing some level of treatment and we're assessing the effectiveness of the intervention or the treatment. All types of studies are equally important. and like you said, without the research participant, we would never be able to actually do the research. And the thing is, especially, you know, after brain injury, I mean, there are so many people in this world that have a traumatic brain injury each year. But when we are trying to do our research, it's extremely important that we get larger numbers of participants to participate in our study, because the more people that we have in our studies, the more diversity of people that we have in our studies that are willing to help us out, the more we are going to be able to learn from the research and be able to generalize to more people. Because if we only have a handful of people in our studies, then very often we have to start out that way, it's very difficult to make inferences and judgments about what the research is actually telling us. We're going to get a more accurate finding if we can have more people participating in our studies. And if people aren't, you know, willing to do this, we're never going to be able to accomplish that. So it's hugely important, and we are so grateful to our participants.
So, you know, when people come, as they get a brain injury, or, you know, they just have a loved one with a brain injury, do they just go to local hospitals or local colleges? And it's probably the bigger colleges, really, that they would go to check out research, would you say? Because this show airs all over, so...
Yeah, you can definitely go to the local college websites. Many college websites actually will have a page where you can look up all of the different studies, the current studies that are going on at the university and stuff. So that's one way to do it. Another way is any clinical research that's being done should actually be listed on clinicaltrials.gov. So getting on the website clinicaltrials.gov and finding out, you can search all different types of stuff, so finding out what research is being done in brain injury locally for you is another way to do it. And then you can also go to, a lot of studies are funded federally through NIH, the National Institutes of Health, or through NIDER, which is another federal funding agency, the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. You can always look up studies on those websites as well, so, and find out what current studies are ongoing for brain injury research.
That's some great information, and what I will want to share too, because a lot of people with brain injury don't drive, is that if you have a friend or family member that could drive you, sometimes they're looking for people that do not have brain injury too. So they may be able to get involved in maybe not that same study, but a different study, so that it may be easier to get to these research facilities if, you know, whoever is taking you can participate too. And then it's a double whammy.
Right. Right. The transportation always creates a huge, huge challenge for many of our participants, especially when they can't drive. And if it's a study that requires multiple visits, that makes things very difficult. So it does require a lot of creativity. It does require a lot of support, you know, because if you are somebody with a brain injury that can't drive, very often you are relying on friends and family members and stuff to get you to a session for your study, for the research. And we do try very hard, many of us who do brain injury research, to include stipends, to include, you know, extra funds to participate in the study to compensate for costs of gas, or being even sometimes making available taxi transportation.
Oh, that's okay. That's interesting. I didn't know that about the taxi.
On occasion,
sometimes
when there are studies that have been funded that have enough funds that allow that to happen, we very often try to make that something that we do to offset some of those challenges and some of those barriers and make it easier for participation. And I also know that, especially with the new, with all of the technology that we have nowadays with, like, GoToMeeting and Skype and things of that nature, I am aware several of my colleagues do engage in sort of, like, tele-rehabilitation health and tele-research where they can actually can participate in research studies on GoToMeeting or via phone calls, things like that. So people, we are starting to evolve and understand that we need to reach people, one, who can't drive, and two, people who live in much more rural areas that live far away and don't live close by to, you know, hospitals and universities and stuff. So some of the research really is starting to take advantage of all of, like, the new technology and stuff and incorporating that in as well. So that's something to look out for.
Yeah, those are some new exciting things coming into the research world and bringing research to the people, which I think will be a positive for everybody.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about what has been the most recent research that you've gotten your information back on.
Oh, so let's see. The most recent, I could actually tell you, so in terms of a study that I've completed, the actual study.
And that you've got the information back so we can share.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working, having my hands in a lot of different things right now.
awesome.
Yeah, which is great. I'm always trying to stay busy and stuff. But one of the most recent studies that I just completed was a study that was actually funded by NIDR, the National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation Research, and this was a study looking at trying to understand what things might be contributing to feelings of irritation and anger after traumatic brain injury. And I had this hypothesis that sometimes irritation and anger might be related to the way a person with a brain injury is interpreting other people's actions and behaviors, and kind of interpreting those behaviors in a way that might not necessarily be accurate. So, for instance, if I'm interacting with somebody and they do something that's completely meant to be completely harmless and benign, I might look at that action and say, well, geez, they did something, that action was hostile, or it had a mean intention behind it, or this person might be to blame for a negative outcome that I experienced. So it's basically making judgments, a negative judgment about other people's actions that then wind up having a negative effect on me. And then because of the way I'm interpreting their behavior, this then triggers a feeling of irritation and anger. And so this was a study. I had 48 participants with traumatic brain injury participate. And what we had them do is we had them read these hypothetical scenarios that would describe a situation that in the end would have a negative consequence, supposedly, hypothetically, on the person with the brain injury. And each scenario would describe a character in this story. And after reading each scenario, the person, the participant had to report how irritated and angry they would be in response to the situation, and how intentional they felt the character's behavior was. So did they do this on purpose? They also had to report how hostile or how mean they felt that the person's behavior was. And then they also had to report whether or not they felt that the character's behavior was the reason, was the blame for a negative outcome for them. And so then we then looked at the association between their reports of how irritated and angry they would feel with these negative attributions or these negative judgments. So what we wound up finding is that the more intentional or the more hostile or the more blameworthy they felt that the person's behavior was, the more irritated and angry they reported they would be. the really interesting piece about this study, though, is so this kind of makes sense, right? This is kind of like, well, duh, of course, you know, if you think somebody's behavior is intentional or hostile, of course you're going to be irritated or angry. It wouldn't everybody. But the really interesting component to the study is that these scenarios were designed so that a third of them described a very hostile situation. So it's clear that the person's behaviors were hostile. And then another third described these behaviors that were kind of ambiguous. So they may have been hostile, they might not have been, they're kind of ambiguous. So if you're that person that would give somebody the benefit of the doubt, you might not necessarily lean to assume that this person's behavior was negative. And then the remaining third of the scenarios described scenarios that were clearly benign, like they meant no harm whatsoever. And what we were finding in this research is that about 30% of our participants rated those ambiguous behaviors to be just as negative as the hostile behaviors. So even though when it wasn't clearly obvious whether or not somebody's behaviors were, you know, had a mean intent behind it, people, you know, some 30% of our participants were actually interpreting these, you know, uncertain behaviors as actually being quite negative, and in the end had this was associated with stronger feelings of irritation and anger in a situation that probably didn't warrant it.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. I don't have my facts on this one, but it's pretty typical that brain injury people are very self-absorbed. You know, is that a true, where they have a hard time seeing that people around them as much, that they do take on that is always against them? I guess I'm not saying that correctly. Sorry, I've been studying way too much this week. My head's going.
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
I was just thinking that you know, after your brain injury, it's, you know, you're trying so hard to get your cognition back and to get those things that sometimes it's hard to see the world around you, and you know, until you're a little healthier, you know. And could that alone bring frustration out?
Yes. So I think you make a really good point. So, obviously, if somebody's having difficulties with the way that they're thinking, their cognition and stuff, that actually is going to be, can very often be a source of stress, of anxiety, of frustration, and make somebody much more irritable and angry. So especially, you know, early on, those things can definitely be contributed. And so we have seen an association, a relationship between cognition, especially like executive functioning, those skills that have to do with problem solving, being strongly related to irritation and anger and frustration. The study that I just got finished with, our patients were on average 5 years post-injury. So these people were many years post, and you know, still, I mean, we did some cognitive testing with them. We did in order to interpret what is the relationship between this. Now, we didn't have enough participants to fully analyze this association, but there does seem to be some indication that there is an association between this type of thought pattern and some executive functioning skills, which makes sense, because if we're thinking about it, if we're having issues with cognition, it's very likely that we're going to misinterpret other people's behaviors. It's that some of those problems, those cognitive issues, where we're looking at something and our perception about it is not quite right, and it's because of, you know, some of that, those cognitive issues.
Very well could be, yes. I think that's a great thing. Sorry, I was really listening to you, and I got lost in what you were saying. Like, wow, that is great. So how – oh, my mind is not working great today. I'm sorry.
No worries.
So what can we do if we find that we have that negative, that we jump to conclusions that there's a negative, you know, that everything is being happening to us? Because, you know, really, you know, people are projecting everything at us, so how someone acts a lot of times towards us has nothing to do with us and a lot to do with them. So how can we educate ourselves or to move forward so that negative perception doesn't continue to go on?
Yeah, and I think that's a good question. And I think so. This is basically the first study that was ever done on this. So we don't really fully understand what are the factors that are associated to it. So the next step is for us to get a better handle on what puts somebody with a brain injury at risk for having these problems. And what is associated with it? So what is actually contributing to it? Is it the cognitive problems? Is there an association between anxiety and depression, et cetera? So we need to fully better understand what is causing somebody to have these misperceptions in order to say how can we treat it. Now, I think that there are certain, you know, cognitive things that we need to think about, but I also think, I mean, this type of research, it's very, very similar to it lends itself to this cognitive behavioral therapy that we see so often. A lot of times cognitive behavioral therapy is a type of therapy that's often used to help people with brain injury, teaching them to reframe the way they think about situations. And it is something that has been used to treat anger and aggression after brain injury. My thought is that it's been more loosely approached in terms of, okay, well, let's just think about all different things, and let's change the way you see something. Let's stop and think about the situation, and your interpretation is this. Well, let's try and think about seeing it from a different perspective. Let's try to, you know, see the situation in a different light and try to figure out why this person may have done this. And so figuring out, you know, that there's not just one side to the story, and that you do have to stop seeing things from yourself, because like you said, it's kind of like a lot of times you hear that people with brain injury become very self-involved and they're seeing things from their own point of view, but they're much less likely to actually take a step back and see things from another person's point of view and see the situation like, oh, how does Julie see this versus how does Dawn see this? And why, you know, from Julie's eyes, it looks like this, and this is why she may have done this.
Do you think it could be because, you know, if you had cognitive issues after your brain injury, you're trying to get that box so there's some shape to it in your head. I know I'm kind of making this up in my head, but, you know, you're trying to get some structure in your head again, which you've never had to do before a brain injury. And now that that's why people get self-involved is because you're trying to, for me, it's like sometimes I just got to slow the thoughts down or I have to, you know, get them in line again. And so it has to be structured. Well, then we're asking them to think out of the box almost, you know. You know, yeah, well,
right.
I know you need to be more structured in your thinking so that things, you know, go in line. But now, we're telling you that can't work when you're thinking about somebody else. So that, I can see where aggravation can come in that.
Yeah, and I don't really know the answer to that. I think that's something that, you know, research should also be looking into. But I think that, I think that it seems like it's a logical assumption to make. I mean, when you think about, obviously, having a brain injury makes everything, and you can speak to this much better than I do. I only know this through talking with my participants and patients and stuff. They say that, you know, everything is just 10 times more effort than it's ever been. So every little thing requires so much energy and effort, hence one of the reasons why there's often so much problem. so many problems with fatigue after brain injury. If you're constantly having to think so hard about every little thing, how do you, you know, so like you said, you can only have so much attention to go around, and so you're basically focusing all of that attention internally just to kind of probably keep up.
Yes, I agree. So, I mean, in school, you know, I have some great professors. Sometimes I'm like, okay, I don't understand this. Can you word it differently? And then I know they can see it in my eyes where my head's just spinning inside. And it doesn't happen all the time, but if I'm fatigued, if I haven't eaten right, if I haven't been exercising, you know, these are things that I know that can keep me at my peak or, you know, at the best. And I'll say, I'm going to have to come back to you because it's spinning. I can't. And, you know, they're words, but I don't understand them, you know.
Right.
But I think it's a lot of self-knowledge to do that. You have to know yourself enough to say, you know what, I got to back up because this isn't working. You know, try again later.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right, exactly. And I think that that's the same thing with some of the stuff that I'm talking about. Like, again, the research is really new, but I think that if you're a person with a brain injury and you think you might be, you know, have this tendency to have this bias, this almost paranoid type thoughts that think people are doing things, you know, maliciously or with a negative intent, is that to stop and say, okay, wait a second, my first thought is not always right, and I need to rethink, you know, maybe the different possible reasons why this can be occurring. Now, I know that sounds that's so much easier said than done, because talking, again, to so many people with a brain injury, they're like, but it happens so fast to me. Something happens and I react and it just goes off, you know, and it's so hard for me to have that moment where I can say, well, let me think about this. It's just like this instantaneous reaction to something, and it seems like, you know, there's really no time to really think through things. But I think, you know, as people are, you know, as they're increasing their awareness for having something like this, I think that that's a really big piece of it, is increasing awareness. And you know, one of the things we found a relationship, an association between this tendency to think this way and people who have high trait aggression. So if they have a tendency to be aggressive, they're going to be more likely to think this way. And we also found a relationship with empathy as well. So the less empathic somebody was, and specifically, there's different types of empathy, but in particular, with empathy, there's your empathic concern. So how much concern do you have for other people? That's your more emotional empathy, but then there's also what we call cognitive empathy. So your ability to think about things and see things from another person's perspective, that's also considered empathy. And this perspective taking, I think kind of like what you were just talking about, like being so involved in yourself versus thinking about things, perceiving things from somebody else's point of view, that we also found that to be highly correlated with this type of tendency. The less they were able to see things from another person's point of view, then the more negative they judged other people's behaviors.
I really can relate to everything that you've just said. And I think I had to teach myself, and I don't think it came naturally after my brain injury. I think it was like almost like teaching yourself how to ride a bike. You know, that you just had to relearn a different way of doing things. And so now when when someone does something and I have a, like, oh my gosh, what, you know, not a hateful, but a, you know, negative thought, why they're doing something, you know, my first instinct is go, ooh, red flag, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't take it personally, you know, just because someone did something to me, I can't take it personally because, you know, who knows how their day has been. And so I think it's something I had to retrain myself. You know, because I used to think that everybody looked at me funny and I was, you know, it was that chaos in the head going on. And I had to stop and say, you know what, I have to distance myself from that, because any time that we do anything on emotion, our logic goes away. So,
Sometimes. Well, so it's such an interesting thing. I mean, that could get us in a philosophical debate and stuff, but it's kind of ironic because everybody thinks that that emotions shouldn't be anywhere where decision making is, but that's actually, it's almost the reverse, that emotions are very important to decision making. We need to think about things, but if we are ourselves in a high emotional state, like anxiety or anger or whatever, we are ourselves in a high emotional state, then we don't think logically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think you can see all the sides. You know, what is the other side? You know, I always look like I'm weighing something with my hands, because, like, when I'm trying to decide something, I'm like, okay, it's on this side and then on this side, and I'm trying, you know, having my internal debate on my decision-making, trying to see both sides. And I think it's a skill that we have to relearn.
I think that's awesome that you have that awareness and that you were able to retrain yourself. I mean, this is something, I don't know, is this something that you received therapy for, or it's just kind of your own internal awareness and said, hey, this is important that I do this?
Well, I just saw that sometimes my decision-making was more emotional, and you know, in the long run, it wasn't helping me. And if I would have been able to step back a little bit, and go, you know, what am I not seeing? Because usually when we're mad at a situation, we're not seeing the whole picture. And, you know, but again, it's something that, you know, yoga taught me a lot of it too. You know, I did yoga for a lot of years, and I really, that helped me understand my body and my emotions and bringing them together. Mm. But, and I think yoga would be wonderful for brain injury patients, but it has to be with the right instructor. I mean, somebody who's well-trained and not just weekend, you know, because there's so many limitations that, yeah, they need to know about and do. But anyway, that's a different story. But where were we? My ADD just came talking. Oh, about being awareness. I think awareness is key. And, you know, do you think you can teach people awareness?
So you talked about, so just in general, self-awareness, it is something that as a cognitive therapist, I've always done, and I have so many thoughts in terms of answering that question. So yes, I do believe that awareness is something that is learnable, that is teachable. If somebody that lacks self-awareness can improve their self-awareness. And I know it's a skill that is often addressed as part of therapy in terms of helping people to be better. Judges are, aware of how, you know, what are their strengths, what are their weaknesses, et cetera, by using immediate feedback type strategies, things of that nature actually can help to improve general awareness. But then if you're talking about awareness for other people's emotions, or awareness for your own emotions, and again, I think that this is something that's teachable. Through some of the research that I've done, we've actually seen that people can increase their awareness to be more alert and in tune to and attentive to other people's emotions and thinking about the situation from another person's perspective. It is something that's teachable. Not easy,
now, I noticed,
but it's teachable.
I noticed on your bio that a lot of nonverbal communication. Do you see, I feel like I learned, because after my car accident, sometimes when people talk, it was like Charlie Brown's teacher, so I tended, I mean, this was 20 years ago, too, so it was a long time ago, but I tended to, like, go off their body language more than, because I couldn't understand or comprehend what they were saying sometimes. So just so I didn't sound stupid, you know, okay, you know, follow that. Do you think that normally it's not that way? Or, I mean, of course, every brain injury is different, we know, but...
Right. So basically, if I heard right, because there's still noises in the background, so sometimes it's a little hard for me to hear you, but so were you just saying that so after your brain injury, you tended to use nonverbal cues more often, like facial expressions and body language and things of that nature to help you interpret a situation because you didn't fully understand the text of what they were saying?
Yes, and I still see myself, which I've had challenges on it, coming back to school. You know, I don't think people believe I had a brain injury, so they challenged a lot. And since it's typical that, you know, people with brain injury don't get verbal cues or nonverbal cues, they're like, well, no, you misinterpret it. And I'm like, you know, I can't see any other way, which I'm very good at looking at both sides, you know.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that I can't see it, you know. Where was I going with that? Oh, gosh, my ADD is really bad today. I am so sorry for this. Sometimes it shows my brain injury. Keeps on going.
Don't worry about it. Well, there's just so much. There's so much stuff to talk about. So it's like it could be all over the place. But it's easy to be thinking about so many different things at once. But So in my research, I've actually happened to notice the opposite. So what we have found,
okay.
I do a lot of research in looking at the ability of people with traumatic brain injury to recognize other people's emotions through nonverbal cues. And my area specifically has to do with recognizing emotions from facial expressions. And we had actually done my group of colleagues, so myself, one of my colleagues, Duncan Babbage, who is from New Zealand, another colleague from Brock University in Canada and St. Catharines, and then Barry Willer, who is at the University of Buffalo in New York, we did a meta-analysis looking at and what that is basically means that we took a bunch of different studies that have looked at, researched emotion recognition in people with traumatic brain injury, specifically looking at facial expressions. And we put all of those studies together in order to give us a higher powered study. So instead of having 20 people in a study, when you combine 10 studies that have 20 people, and then you have a whole lot of subjects, right?
And yeah, so, great.
Right, so you have more power because the more subjects you have, the more that this is going to give you a better indicator of what's actually going on, hopefully. At least that's the idea. What we found is that anywhere between 30% and 50% of people with moderate to severe traumatic brain injuries have difficulty recognizing emotions from facial expressions. And so this is kind of a big number to think about. And, you know, some people might say, oh, well, really, who cares? You know, what's the big deal? So you can't read emotions from facial expressions, you know. But, you
know,
in actuality, it's a huge thing when we're interacting with people. Like, only 7%, according to Albert Mehrabian, only 7% of our emotions are expressed verbally. The rest of our emotions are expressed through our body language and through our tone of voice. So how we say something, not what we say, and our facial expressions are considered to be the most important of all of the other nonverbal cues. So if you can't recognize what somebody's face, you know, what their facial expression is, well, think about how that can be contributing to a misinterpretation of somebody else's intentions. So if somebody's actually looking sad, but you assume that they're angry, well, then you're like, you're going to respond very differently to somebody that looks to somebody who is angry compared to somebody who is sad. If you see somebody that's sad, if your friend is sad, you're going to try to console and help that person, right? Now all of a sudden you're seeing this person angry. Well, maybe you're likely to get defensive. You're going to start getting angry yourself, and the way you interact with that person is going to be completely differently. And if you start responding to this person as if they're angry, your reaction is completely inappropriate, and then the person that you're interacting with is going to be like, what is this person doing? And it's just going to create this negative interaction. So looking at emotion recognition from faces is a really big part of my research, and has actually stemmed to several other studies, too, that I've been working on. And some of them have to do with, so what is it? So why do people with brain injury have difficulty recognizing emotions from facial expressions? And so that's kind of, that has branched off into two different studies for me. One of them I've already completed, and one of them we're in the process of finishing up recently. The one that I have completed is we were looking at what the relationship of emotion recognition from facial expressions, how is that related to the ability of a person with a brain injury to recognize their own emotions. And so the theory there that kind of drives this is saying, hey, if I can't recognize my own feelings, how on earth can I recognize anybody else's feelings?
Yeah.
So I mean, and the thing is, it's really interesting because so I started looking into this, and this is a condition that most people probably have not heard of, but it's called alexithymia. Because you have what, in looking at this research, I found that about anywhere between 30% and 60% of traumatic brain injury actually have what's called alexithymia. And alexithymia literally translates into meaning no words for emotion, without words for emotion.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so it doesn't mean that the person with a brain injury doesn't have emotions. This person can be actually, in fact, very emotional. They just don't fully understand their emotions. They might not be aware of their emotions. They don't know the words for their emotions. They can't label their emotions. They can't differentiate their emotions. So maybe there's this mixture or this blend of sad, angry, and fearful going on, but they can't really pull them apart. So instead of being able to understand what they are, it just creates a feeling of confusion.
I got a question for you. Now, this is something that, one thing that I have a problem with, which, most people wouldn't know I have a brain injury if they meet me on the streets, and unless I'm at school, unless I tell someone, most people wouldn't know because I don't have any outward signs. Most brain injury people don't, but when I start talking and I get excited, I may sound like I'm angry, but inside I'm not angry, but my emotion or, the physical part is not, I may be fine and calm inside, but my voice is getting loud, the tone, people may say, well, you sound angry. And then as soon as they say that, I'm like, oh, really? Because then I can calm my body down and go, oh, I'm sorry. That's not what I feel inside. Do you see any of that? Because a lot of times when people say that, oh, you sound angry. I'm like, oh, I sound angry? Because I'm not. I may be excited, or something, passionate, but it's not, So I was just wondering if you see any of that disconnect.
Well, yeah, and I think a couple different thoughts there, but yeah, I think that that's interesting. I think so, maybe you are getting very excited and you're not realizing, internally what is going on, and so there is this disconnect, and it is being expressed kind of, it's not coming out, it's being, not correct in an incorrect way. So one of the things, that we also see with this condition of alexithymia, this lack of emotional awareness, it actually is highly correlated with aggression. And it's this idea that if you can't be in tune with what's going on internally in your body, it means you might not necessarily pick up on, if your muscles are tense or if your heart rate is elevated or if your temperature level is raised, if you kind of gotten flushed, things like that. It's just if you're not in tune with those things, but then it's still going to affect your behavior. And then so there's sort of this complete disconnect. And if you are not aware of it, how can you regulate your emotions if you don't even know what your emotions are?
Yes. But even when you do know what your emotions are, I think that's my problem, because if someone says it to me and they're like, you're getting loud, oh, I am, and I can calm it down because then I can be aware of it at that moment. But if I'm comfortable, if I'm not going, make sure that your tone of voice is low, because, one of my biggest things is people say that I can talk loud. Now, a lot of people now that know me, they're like, I don't think you talk loud, but I think it's from many years of being consciously aware of it and making a choice to be, to talk lower, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm comfortable and I'm not paying attention, I can talk really loud and, you know, be, I think, more physically, probably, I don't, other people may see it as aggressive, and, you know, it, but I don't mean it to be. So, you know, would that be a part of that, that new thing that you were talking about? Alexia. Yeah,
it's supposed to be. I mean, to me, it sounds like there could be a relationship. I mean, it's really, it would be really hard for me to say based on that description, yes or no.
Right.
But, you know, I think it sounds like it, you know, there could be some sort of connection there. Of just, I think it has to do, you know, it sounds to me, I mean, when you, this condition really is, it has to do with a lack of awareness. You know, this is, you know, specifically this condition is a lack of awareness for your emotions versus a more general lack of awareness. But I think, you know, the second somebody brings it to your attention, it's just like, oh, okay, well, now I'm more aware of it. I can be more, you know, you then start to focus on it, and then you have more control over it. So, I mean, it very well could be a part of it. But so one of the things that I really want to start doing is, So the research that I wound up doing is looking at this relationship between this lack of emotional self-awareness, this alexithymia issue, with its relationship with recognizing other people's emotions. And in fact, those two things are related to each other. And so my thought is, well, if we want to be able to help people with brain injury better recognize other people's emotions, we really need to start from the beginning. We need to help them better recognize their own emotions before we start teaching them how to recognize other people's emotions.
Yeah.
Or at least that's to be part of it, which is kind of backwards because my very first research project, my dissertation project, was on an intervention that I developed to help people with brain injury better recognize emotions from facial expressions. And I wound up doing that research for my dissertation, and then it evolved into, we wound up getting federal funding for it, which was wonderful, and we it was awesome. We wound up doing this multi-site study, so meaning that we had three different sites involved in doing this intervention that we developed. And it was international, too. This was a study that took place at the time I was doing my postdoc in Charlotte, North Carolina. So it took place in Charlotte, North Carolina. It took place in St. Catharines, Ontario, in Canada, and in Wellington, New Zealand. So very international. We had over 70 participants go through our treatment. We screened over 270 people qualified, which meant that they had difficulty recognizing emotions from facial expressions. And then they went through a 3-week intervention where we brought them in and showed them pictures of facial expressions on the computer, and we taught them how to look at the different facial features and associate the different facial features to the different emotions. And then we also did talk about, you know, well, you're recognizing this emotion in this picture of this facial expression, but we also had them mimic the facial expression and talk about how their own experiences with those same emotions to help them better connect with those emotions themselves. And we did find after this, it was a 3-year study, like I said, over 70 participants went through the intervention. We found, and this was, and we compared the real intervention, that intervention, to another intervention where we just had people come in and do work on the computer to address their memory problems, problem solving, visual attention, scanning, things like that. So the people that were not getting the real intervention were still coming in, and they were still getting the same time and attention from a therapist, just like the people that went through the real intervention. And we found out that the intervention that we developed did help people with brain injury to significantly better recognize emotions from facial expression. So it was really exciting.
Was that interface?
The interface is a new center that we have at the Rehabilitation Hospital of Indiana. It's a center that the interface stands for Interactive and Functional Assessment of Communication and Emotion. So it's a laboratory that we developed and just recently opened in November 2013 that is equipped with all of the coolest, newest, high-tech, advanced equipment to study and treat emotional deficits after brain injury. So the interface is a center. It's a lab that's kind of designed to go forward and do a lot of different neat studies to help us better understand emotional problems in people with neurological deficits, including brain injury. But this research that I'm talking about, that was done outside of the interface.
That was before. That gave you a lot of information to go on to do the interface and things, right? Correct?
Right, exactly. So all of this past research that I'm talking about, that was what put me in this direction of wanting to build something, a center that gives us a better, that we can use to really study some of the core problems. And still trying to figure out and understand what is contributing to why people with brain injury have difficulty recognizing other people's emotions. And so, especially from facial expressions. So more recently, I just got involved with my first fMRI study, so functional magnetic resonance imaging, looking at what's going on, the activity in the brain when a person is processing facial expressions, and wanting to use to conduct this study so that we can understand where is the breakdown actually occurring? Where is the difference? And so we're coming towards the tail end of that study, and we're doing a couple different things with it. But it's a really neat study, and we have three different groups in the study. We have people with traumatic brain injury who have facial impairments of recognizing emotions from faces. Then we have a group of people with traumatic brain injury that don't have an impairment. They recognize emotions from faces just fine. And then we have a group of healthy control subjects who recognize emotions just fine. And what we wanted to see is that group of people with traumatic brain injury who do have difficulty and compare them to the people with and without TBI that don't have a problem and see what's going on in their brain that's different. And what might be contributing to some of these problems. And the really interesting thing that we're finding, we did some preliminary analyses of these results, and we're finding that the problem might be when we look at facial expressions in general, most people we have to process facial expressions very quickly because facial expressions are constantly changing. They're dynamic. They don't stay static for a very long time. They're moving. And we need to pick up on this information very quickly. There's always other things going on, so it can't really take a whole lot of time or attention. It needs to be done very automatically. And so what this type of processing is, we look at the face as a whole. We look at it globally, like in this kind of this one take, we see it all. And there's a certain part of the brain that's associated with that. I don't know if you want to know the area of the brain that's involved in that. I can tell you.
Absolutely, love to.
The amygdala is definitely involved in some things, but this area of the brain that is highly associated with processing information from the face, it's located in the temporal lobe. And mm-hmm. it's called the fusiform gyrus or the fusiform face area. And this, because a lot of people call it the fusiform face area because it's so highly involved in processing the face. It means we look at the face and we process it as one whole piece of information rather than looking at here's an eye, here's another eye, here's the eyebrow, here's the nose, here's the mouth. We just look at the face and we see it all and take it all in at once. That allows us to see it very quickly. Now, research has been done in children with autism that found, hey, this area of the brain actually is not as active as it should be. And children with autism also have difficulty processing emotions from faces. And so they came to this idea that, hey, children with autism, they're not looking at these faces as a whole. No, instead, they're actually looking at feature by feature. They're actually, and they spend a lot more time looking at the mouth rather than the eyes. And so much information is in the eyes. And if you just look at the mouth, you're missing, you know, the majority of information about the expression. And so that's one of the reasons why we did this study with traumatic brain injury, to see if there was something similar going on. And from our preliminary analyses, it's suggesting that people with brain injury are doing the same thing. They are not processing the face. That area, that fusiform face area, is not as active. It looks like they're looking at, you know, feature by feature, which is takes too long. That's not as efficient. And so the cool thing is now we have a little bit more money. We're going to bring back our participants who've already participated in the imaging portion, and they're going to come into our new interface center where we have this awesome eye tracking equipment. There's a computer. There's no strings attached, nothing. It can just track where you're looking at on the computer monitor without anything touching you. Yeah, it's really wild, and you can see where somebody looks. You can see the sequence of their eye movements. You can see the duration of their eye movements. You can see all kinds of information. And so what we're going to do is we're having these people come back in, and we're going to show them these pictures of facial expressions again, and we're going to look to see where their eyes go and how do they actually, what are the patterns when they look at faces, and compare them, you know, compare these results across the three different groups to say, to get additional support that, hey, it does have to do with the way they're looking at the face.
Oh, interesting. That's a neat research being done, and it's really going to change how probably the cognitive therapy of people with brain injury.
Right. Well, at least that's the intention. Everything, all of the research that I do, it's really to get more information as to what is contributing to the problem, so then when we actually go to address the problem, we know we're armed with more information about how we should more effectively try to approach the issue. And then we need to then test, you know, how effective that approach is. You know, like I said, you know, we developed an intervention to actually help with better recognize emotions from facial expressions, and we did this, and it helped, but it didn't help everybody, and it definitely can still be improved upon, and that's kind of the goal of, you know, a lot of what drives my research is let's really get to the heart of this, and really let's understand what's happening here, so that we can really improve these treatments.
So, what are you researching now? What are you taking participants doing now?
So that study is still ongoing. So that's one of the things
okay.
that I'm doing right now.
But that's with Pat. You've already done, your participants have done the fMRI, and now they're coming to do this,
right?
They do
the fMRI,
right?
Yeah. Right, now they're coming for the eye tracking.
People who are listening that wanted to maybe come and try some new therapy with you, do some research with you.
So as far as actually, that is a thing that I actually have going on absolutely right now. Now, the other thing that's really, I'm really excited about, I was telling you about this condition called alexithymia. This lack of emotional awareness, so the lack of awareness for your own emotions. Well, I just recently got a grant from the NIH, from the National Institutes of Health, to develop a product, a virtual reality program that I'm designing to teach people with brain injury to have more emotional awareness and better be able to label and understand their emotions and pay attention to their emotions in these virtual social scenarios. So giving them a basis of like foundation of like, you know, a better emotional vocabulary, so learning more words to describe their emotions, helping them better figure out what their emotions are, and then putting them in these social scenarios and helping them process how they are feeling in the midst of an actual scenario, like, or an actual interaction with somebody. And so this is a one-year grant, and for the first 7 to 8 months, the grant is the study is me developing the protocol and the virtual reality scenarios. And then the last several months is we need to recruit 15 participants. So it's a very small study. We need to recruit 15 participants who have problems with their own emotional awareness to come in. It's going to be a one-month intervention, so it's 8 sessions. It would be twice a week for 4 weeks. Where they would come in, work, you know, interact with this virtual reality program, and we're going to test them before and afterwards to see how helpful and effective the program is. And so that's something I'm really excited about. And so because right now I'm in the development stage, we anticipate that research, like where we would start enrolling patients in January. But I am actually taking a list of names of people who are interested in participating so that I can call them once we get started with enrolling patients. So if people are interested, I would love for them to call, and I could put their name on a list and call them when we actually start doing the study. The major criteria is that people have to have a moderate to severe traumatic brain injury, and by the time when we start testing people, which will be January of 2015, they need to be 12 months post-injury at least. So they need to be in the more chronic phases.
So what are the criteria? Do you have to have a piece of paper from a doctor saying you have moderate brain injury? Or, I mean, how does that work?
That's a great question. We do take a lot of information based on self-report. So we will typically, you know, we'll ask somebody how, you know, did they lose consciousness? If they lost consciousness, how long did they lose consciousness for? That's probably one of the fastest and easiest indicators of a moderate to severe traumatic brain injury. So losing consciousness for over 30 minutes will typically count as having had a moderate to severe brain injury. Length of confusion after the occurrence of their brain injury, CT scans that indicate that there was brain damage. So things like that we can typically go by. And the person does have to have a traumatic brain injury, so that means something more like typically from a motor vehicle accident or a fall or something of that nature versus, unfortunately, we have to start with keeping our population to be one type or another. So because mm-hmm. of traumatic brain injury, we're not including people who have had strokes or things of that nature. It has to have been traumatic.
Now, do they call Jessica? Now, I can put on the TBI Quantum Leap Facebook page the information on how you can get a hold of Dr. Newman's study. Is it Jessica that they would call?
No, not Jessica. I have my name on it, and so you can please post it. I would love if you could do that.
Okay. So why don't you go ahead and give a phone number for where somebody can reach you, because people can go back and listen to these shows. Oh, my goodness. Two more weeks of school. 2 more weeks. I just got to keep on saying that. I'll get my brain back. But people can listen to past episodes, so we want to give them the number if you can, if you have it on you.
Right. Okay, give me 1 second here.
No problem. And another thing that, like Dr. McDonald said, if you call and you don't, you know, so much qualify for that study, there may be another one at the center that they may qualify for.
Right,
so
absolutely.
Just call me in.
We have a lot of different studies going on. And I'm actually trying to think of, because I could give you another number. I could give you 2 numbers. So my number, it's Dawn Newman, and you'd be calling. It's 317-329-2188.
All right, and that's if they want to come on or if they're interested about your research and getting on your list.
Yeah, if they're interested in that particular study. And then I'm trying to think. I'm trying to find my colleague's phone number, Elena Gillespie. She's our research coordinator at the Rehabilitation Hospital of Indiana. And I actually am not able to find her number right this moment.
I will look it up. Okay, well, I'll look it up, and I will put it on our website, our Facebook page, so that people can get on and find her number and call her. And, again, if you're listening to the show, you can always just go on TBI, Quantum Leap, on Facebook, and get on there and see this information, or you can just ask questions, and I can get you the information that you're looking for. So, you know, feel free to do that.
Oh, well, I actually just found Elena Gillespie's phone number. If somebody's just interested in research on traumatic brain injury at RHI, she would be the person that has the more general, all of the information on all of our studies versus, if you called me, that would be primarily about that one study I just told you about. But if you want to just find out about the research at RHI, her number is 317-329-2212. And you can always go on the Rehabilitation Hospital of Indiana website that also lists our research.
Wonderful. And whoever they need to get in touch with will be on that on the Facebook or not Facebook the website.
Right.
Correct, right? All right. Wonderful. Well, I appreciate you, Dr. Newman, coming on and sharing this information. Sorry, I was a little scattered today. I'm not normally as scattered when I'm on here. But you had so much information. Would you be willing to come back in the future and maybe share some more of your past research?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. I appreciate you coming on and sharing all the information and helping people get better with brain injury. Your research really matters to us in the brain injury world. So I want to thank you for everybody.
That means so much to me, and it really was my pleasure. I love to be able to do whatever I can to spread the word, and what you're doing is absolutely amazing, getting the word out there and promoting the importance of research. I mean, we thank you, Julie. So thank you so much.
No problem. Well, you have a good night and a great week, and I hope to hear back from you on Quantum Leap.
Sounds good. Awesome. Well, you take care, Julie.
Thank you.
Thanks again. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. What a great guest we had today. Dr. Newman really gave a lot of great information and a lot of learning that we can do and see what is going on in the research world. So you can always go on the Indiana Rehabilitation of Indiana webpage, and I'm sure you can find Dr. Newman's information there and all the other great research that they're doing there. They're a part of Indiana University Medical School, so it's top-notch research there, guys. This is, world-class stuff that is being done, and it's all to help us with brain injury. So please, take the time to listen to some of the past episodes. That'll help educate you, because education is power. The more that you know, the more that you'll be able to go out in the world and succeed. Coming up next at 10 o'clock is going to be Matt Duffin, and he's going to have Sam on, which has a great story. He's such an inspiration to everybody with brain injury, and I'm sure he's going to have lots of good stuff on, so take a break and come back at 10 o'clock. I wish you a good 2 weeks, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Have a great day.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.